Hello and welcome to Geround, the podcast for design information and spatial matters. We have quite an interesting talk in front of us. Our guest today is Andrew Barker. And for all of you who have listened to our podcast in the last years, you will recognize him because he's now officially the first one who is the second time on our podcast. He's an award-winning designer. He's the head of the Sign Design Society. And he's, and that's the reason why we're talking today, he's a behavioral researcher for the UK government. And just a month ago, there was quite an interesting workshop and conversation with Andrew about all things related to how we can influence behavior when doing wayfinding systems. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Andrew, thank you very much again for giving us your time. And I'm really looking forward to our talk.
You're welcome.
So if we talk about behavior, I mean, from my point of view, it's like in the forefront of everything we do, we try to influence behavior. What has behavioral science, what can behavioral science teach us about this topic that we can use as wayfinders to actually influence behavior? By the way, I liked, I really made a note about this little term that you used during your presentation, which was nudging for good. I liked that a lot.
Yes. Well, I mean, that term comes from the UK government set up a unit called the Behavioural Insights Team. And they were using a lot of thinking from a book which used the word nudge in its title, which was to do with how you nudge people's behavior. You don't force them to do something. They continue to have their own agency and their own autonomy, and they can make choices, but you make the choices that you want them to take, the ones that are somehow easier for them to do. So you're just nudging them in the direction of good choices rather than pushing them or forcing them. And it is important also that it's nudging for good, because it's so easy to use all of these techniques for the sinister purposes.
That's when we'd use the word manipulate, which would be like the negative side of the
Absolutely.
Whole topic.
Yes. And going back to Vance Packard's book from the 1950s, The Hidden Persuaders, which was all about how largely advertising manipulated people's behavior to get them to buy products. Obviously, the whole point of nudging for good is that it's not to do with getting people to buy products, but getting them to make choices that are going to be better for their lives or more healthy for them, those sorts of things.
So how does it relate to wayfinding? What should wayfinding designers look at if thinking about this topic?
Well, I mean, one of the things that wayfinding does in terms of helping people to make good choices is it is helping people to make the good choices about the route that they take. So they take the route that is faster or safer or more pleasant. And I mean, that's kind of so self-evident that it barely needs stating. But there was a project in London recently, which was there is a very busy main road through the top of the centre of London. It's not pleasant to walk along it at all, but it's a really convenient route to get from two large stations. Mm-hmm. And so a wayfinding design company was involved in the project to help people understand there was actually another equally effective route that took them off this main road, so they weren't having to breathe in a huge amount of pollution, but they could make a choice that was going to be better for them. It simply wasn't obvious unless you knew about it. So that was simply a case of putting up signs, making it clear that there was this better alternative route that people could take if they were walking between these two stations. That, you know, there are simple ways like that in which wayfinding can be used to help people make better choices. And a lot of that is around simply providing the information, but there are other ways that that wayfinding design might be engaged in nudging behavior. When you start looking at behavioral science in the environment, that there's research into things about how people don't like walking along corridors that are dark or dirty or don't smell good or may have threatening looking people on them. So that obviously tells you, if you want people to go one way rather than another and you don't have the option of putting up a sign, make the route that you do want them to take, make it clean, make it better lit. Also, if there are other people using that route, it will make people more likely to make the choice of using it. So those are some of the non-sign ways that a wayfinding designer might help a client to understand how to help people make the decisions that they want them to make.
Which I find quite interesting, because I mean the obvious one that you might think automatically, like the nudging effort that we do as wayfinding designers, is like putting a sign where the arrow goes to the left hand side, so we kind of give them the opportunity to tell them, okay, if we mention the goal, the target they're looking for, it's on the left hand side, let's go to the left hand side. We are using a similar example when we are teaching at university. The one basically we ask students when they know that the shopping street kind of is finished, you know, this kind of feeling you get, not okay, there is no more shops, but when do you get the feeling that there won't be many more shops and you start turning around? And there are some environmental clues that clearly communicate, okay, this is the end, let's turn around. And you can use that actively, like you've mentioned with the dark alleyway.
I mean, to put it to frame it in the way that behavioral scientists do, there are two models of how one can influence or nudge people's behavior, which I think are interesting and worth looking at. And the first of these models is called the EAST model, and this was developed by the Behavioral Insights team in the British government. And what EAST stands for is easy, attractive, social, and timely. And what it's saying is that any behavior that you want people to do should be easy, attractive, social, and timely. So the behavior that you want people to adopt, it must be easier to do than the other behaviors, the ones you don't want them to adopt. It must be attractive. There must be something about it that makes it more appealing than the other choices. And social, if you see other people doing it, you're more likely to adopt it yourself. And timely, you need to tell people about that behavior, or the behavior needs to be available to them at the right moment, neither before nor after. So there's that model, the EAST model, which says the behavior must be easy.
But it needs all four of them. It's not just if three are available and the fourth isn't, it doesn't work, or does it work? It really needs all four of them.
Ideally, all four. The likelihood is that one is probably one of those four factors will be the one that you focus on, and the others are there but more in the background. So maybe you focus on making the behavior easier or more attractive. If you can do all four, that's obviously a good thing. The other model that I was going to talk about, and this is the COMB model, and this comes from the Center for Behavior Change at University College London. And what this says is that for people to adopt a behavior, they need the capability, the opportunity, and the motivation to do so. The capability, they need to be able to do that behavior. If the behavior requires you to run fast, then people who can't run fast can't do that behavior. So everyone needs the capability to do that behavior, and they need the opportunity to do that behavior. They need all the resources around them that are going to support it, and they need the motivation to do it as well. They need to actually want to do it. Then they're simply not going to adopt a behavior against mm-hmm. their own will. So I think those two models are interesting because the first one, East, talks about what the behavior itself needs. And the Column B model talks about what the people, what the individuals doing the behavior need. And so they kind of fit together, and it's worth looking at behavior change from both points of view, from what mm-hmm. the person needs and what the behavior needs. It's also worth saying that the Column B model comes from a much bigger structured approach to behavior change called the behavior change wheel. And one of the things that they talk about is they very much describe what they're doing as designing interventions. So that they're very much looking at it from a, how do we design this to make people do what we think would be good for them?
If I understood that correctly, the Combi is more about the person.
Yeah.
And the East model is more about the behavior itself and how it has to be shaped.
Yeah.
The kind of the qualitative aspects of the behavior. I kind of resonated with the time leap of the behavior, so that we have to communicate it when it's necessary at the right time. Because if we're doing like positioning maps, it seems like this is the full effort in positioning it correctly, not too late, not too early, to actually make a difference in the behavior.
Yes, and that somebody I worked with as an information designer, one of the key thing that they used to repeat again and again and again is that you have to provide information at the point of need. And so mm-hmm. that's at the place and the moment. So the point of need in both time and space. And that's very much to do with that timeliness. There's no point in providing information too early or too late or in the wrong place. None of those are effective. It has to be at the moment when the individual needs that behavior, or sorry, needs that information, that then enables them to adopt the behavior.
Can you, you have shown quite some interesting examples during your presentation. Can you give some examples for our listeners on, you know, how you would use the East model to actually make a wayfinding intervention?
The example that I gave in the talk, which I think is quite an interesting example, is an instance where there's an art centre and it has a theatre and it has several bars on different floors within the art centre. Mm-hmm. And the problem they have, their problem statement, is everyone tends to go to the bar on the ground floor because that's the first one they see when they enter the building. And as a consequence, that bar gets very overcrowded. And the other bars are quite often very underused. So just from kind of the comfort of the people in that bar, you'd think if they knew, maybe they'd go and use the other bars. It would also mean the staff in the other bars weren't standing around doing nothing while the people in the bar on the ground floor are running around furiously. Another consequence of this particular behavior that people are automatically adopting is because everyone goes to the bar on the first floor, when they need to take their seats in the theater, unless they're sitting in the stalls, it takes them longer to get to their seats. So quite often the shows start late because people have taken too long to get to their seats. Whereas if they had been on one of the bars on one of the other floors, hopefully then the journey to their seat would have been shorter and they would have been able to get to their seat in a more swift fashion. So what can the art centre do to get people to use the bars that are on the same floors as their seats in the theatre? What do they do about that? So if we look at it from the East model, they somehow have to make going to the other bars within the art centre, they have to make that easy, attractive, social and timely. In terms of being easy, what could you do? I mean, clearly the reason people are going to the bar on the ground floor is because it is somehow easier. Maybe if people are informed that they should go to the bar on the third floor if their seats are on the third floor in the theatre, because it will be easier for them to get from the bar to their seats. Maybe that's one of the kind of the ease factors that could be used. In terms of attractiveness, maybe they need to be shown how attractive the other bars are. They need to, they simply need to see them from that point of view. So maybe the marketing material that they see, maybe some information they get sent with their tickets, maybe that needs to include that information, showing them how attractive these bars are, highlighting the particular attractions of them. Maybe they have better views because they're higher up in the building, something mm-hmm. like that. And in terms of being social, maybe on social media, people need to post about going to bars on the other floors so that other users actually see that other people are doing that. And the information needs to be timely. It needs to be given to people when they're making that decision about which bar to go to. So that might be if they're arranging to meet people at the theatre or in the arts centre, maybe you tell them when they get their tickets, when they're making that arrangement, so they actually have the information they need to arrange to meet people in the bar on the third floor or whatever, or the moment at which they arrive at the arts centre. That's another moment when they might be making that decision. So maybe the information about the other bars needs to somehow be presented before people see the bar on the ground floor and make the decision to go there. Maybe they need to know about the other bars at that moment. There are undoubtedly other more granular, more nuanced things that one could be doing, but just kind of off the top of my head, those are the things that I can think about.
Yeah, I like this example in connection with the model, because it shows very clearly that as wayfinding designers, we have so many different possibilities to shape behavior and even to solve problems. Because if we look at it from the problem perspective, the problem is people are coming too late to the shows and they cannot start properly because it's still loud. And that is like influences the whole experience for everyone. And by using the model, you kind of get a broad, very many possibilities to actually make a difference by just thinking about, okay, what would easy mean in this context, or what would timely mean in this context?
Yeah.
Even going as far as to say, okay, if we don't have a bar at the third floor, let's build one, for example. And that will solve most of the problems. We don't have to put up signs, just build a bar. When people come up, even if they go into the shows, they see the bar already and they know, this will now be the most convenient one because we don't have to go down two flights of stairs.
Yeah, indeed. And one of the things I like about both the East and the ComB model is that it helps to remind us of the full range of things that we might do.
Mm-hmm.
As wayfinding designers, it's very easy to kind of to get stuck into a mindset of it'll need a sign. But actually, there are many, many other things that we can do other than signs, and we need to keep reminding ourselves of what those other possibilities are. And to look at that very much bigger picture of the sorts of ways that we might think about influencing people's behavior.
As a designer, what would you tell wayfinding designers? Should they actually use both models in all situations, or should they focus on one model for specific situations and then the other one? How do you use it in your design processes?
I think I would, in general, start by using both. Certainly when I'm going through the early design stages of a project, where we're maybe thinking as widely as we possibly can about what the solution might be, what using both the models will do is help one to think as broadly as possible about what the full range of solutions might look like. And then after that kind of opening out and looking at as many different things as possible, then when one starts to focus in on maybe one or two or three different solutions that are going to be presented to the client, at that point, you might start thinking about actually where we're really focusing on how the ConV model can help us, or how the EAST model can help us, or even a very particular part of that. We're going to be looking at how we can give people the opportunity to do this behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But as I was saying, the ConV model is part of this very big and elaborate behavior change process called the behavior change wheel. And one of the things about that is it has a large number of really specific types of intervention that you might do. And one of the really interesting things about it is it also has this collection of evidence as to how and why those behaviors have worked in previous case studies. So you can actually see how that type of intervention has been used in the past, which might help you to understand whether it's really going to work for you in your instance. And that might help you to shape the very particular intervention that you're going to make in order to nudge people into the behavior that you're trying to get them to adopt.
That is a good, I think, point in time to mention that we will put all the necessary links into the show notes, and one of the links will be the one mentioned to all these kind of interventions that I'm right now. I'm in this website. It's the theory, the BCT theory and technique tool, and it's quite interesting to actually read through. It has all the information. Is there evidence? No evidence that it can actually shape behavior. It describes all the interventions. It describes all the effects, which is great to look at. And especially as a wayfinding designer, you can look at all the elements that you can use in your own interventions that you're planning. Like, for example, setting a prompt or cues, or what can you do to habit formation? What can you do to habit reversal, which is quite interesting, because sometimes it's not just leading many. Very often in our project, it's not just leading people from A to B. It's all about explaining what happens at B and how they should behave at B, like in a clinic. How about waiting? How about getting a date and so on? So it's quite a good resource for us to actually look into what kind of interventions are possible and to get new ideas again.
It's great because it provides evidence rather than designers having to do that thing that they tend to do of just using their intuition, or, for want of a better way of putting it, guesswork about what's going to work and what's not going to work. Mm-hmm. There's actually a huge body of evidence about what has worked in the past and what hasn't worked, and that means that sometimes the things that we design can be less of a shot in the dark, because there is evidence to demonstrate that it is that this particular approach is likely to work, or a different approach is more likely to work. It's great to have all that evidence, I think.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a book at the very beginning, because we're coming to the end, and I would like a reading tip for our listeners. What kind of book resource would you tell our listeners to read to maybe get more into this topic?
I think the book that I would suggest is, I'm now struggling to remember what the exact title is. I think it's called Inside the Nudge Unit. And it's an account by one of the key people who worked in the Behavioural Insights team, the Nudge Unit, in the British mm-hmm. government. And it's great because it shows you how they did stuff that actually worked. And some of it is really extraordinary, what did and didn't work. And because it's very practical and talks about what works, it's mm-hmm. it's a bit easier for practical people like designers to get into, rather than some of the books about behavioral psychology, behavioral science, and nudging. Some of them are quite theoretical and quite hard to understand, or quite simply hard to know how to put them into practice, whereas the Inside the Nudge Unit book, after we finish this conversation, I'll go away and find the proper title for it.
It's Inside the Nudge Unit.
Is that the right title? Thank you.
Yeah, it's called Inside the Nut Unit, How Small Changes Can Make a Big Difference, from David Halpern.
One of the examples that I remember from it, which I love because it's just such a tiny thing and it worked so effectively, they were working with, I think, Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, the people who are responsible for making sure that we pay our tax in the UK. And they were talking about sending out reminders to people. So these are physical letters they were sending out at that point, I think. And although they might have been emails, even it would work in either. They needed to get people to do something after they'd sent these letters. And they were finding it quite hard to get people to. It was a simple thing like just make sure that they had registered for something that year, or it was quite a simple behaviour they had to do. But people simply weren't doing it when they received the reminder letter. They found that if they put a photograph of a smiling face on the letter, more people responded in the way they wanted them to. And it was
really,
it's just so ridiculously simple. It's just that there was something to do with the fact that it was a person and they were smiling, and it kind of, it's building on those, I think, the kind of all of the social behaviours that are so wired into us, that if we think we're going to get that sort of a social approval from doing this behaviour, then we're more likely to do it. So, you know, sometimes the things that you can do are really simple, and that book is, I think, a really good introduction to understanding how we can actually operationalise some of the otherwise quite hard to understand theory that sits behind it.
Apart from the book, maybe to mention that for all Sign Design Society members, the full presentation of Andrew is of course available for all the members for free, I think.
It's on our website, yes.
Yes. And if you're not yet a member, maybe it's worth it just to get this and other talks and other presentations that are available. It was quite an interesting one, and I've learned a lot from it. Final question, Andrew. As usual, when have you laughed really hard the last time?
I think that was probably watching a recording of Tommy Cooper on the television. And for those who aren't familiar with British comedy of the 1970s, Tommy Cooper was a comedian who most of his routines comprised him doing magic acts that failed.
Oh yeah, and
there's just something about him that is sublimely silly. And it somehow makes it look like it could possibly be a piece of conceptual art or performance art, but it continues to work on this level of just utter absurdity as well. He makes me laugh a great deal. It's not the sort of thing I would expect to find funny, but it just makes me laugh so much.
Actually, I like him too. I've come across him through, I think it was Instagram or YouTube Shorts, I'm not sure. But I like that he's not a big talker. He is really all about presence and, you know, the tricks, how he performs. Yeah. All the tricks. It's really good.
His facial expressions and his body language do so much of the work for him. Yeah.
So much about nudging for good. So he nudges us to really laugh out loud.
Absolutely.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much again for your time and the valuable insight into behavioral science. I hope maybe you will be the first one to talk the third time too as well. Let's see. But thanks for that talk.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me back.